My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. And I'm so glad that I was able to go to La Prade tonight and eat with great moderation. I still lie a lot. It's perfectly understandable and all right if any of you go to sleep. Just please don't snore. And let out a little yell if you see the speaker drifting off. We have a little house a few miles from here, and my wife had never been to La Prade before, and she said, we'll have to go over there every weekend. We come up here. If I went over every weekend, we'd have to have another anonymous, but people that eat La Prade too much. Any of y'all that want to come on back next weekend, I understand we're going to meet again. Brookings going to be all right. I looked up and down that big long table at La Prade tonight, as I always do when I'm with a group of alcoholics. And I love to listen to the laughter. I love to listen to the sharing, the fun. And when I realize what it is we're doing there and here tonight, we are treating a terminal illness. You know, what a wonderful treatment it is. I still believe with all my heart that we're the luckiest people on the face of this earth. And we'll talk about that a little bit more a little later. I first always like to start with a little story because when I first came to you people, I heard people talking about a thing called an alcoholic personality. And I didn't know what an alcoholic personality was, so I started asking questions. I got about 150 different answers, none of which made any sense whatsoever to me. None of them in my mind answered the question. And so one old timer told me, son, I'm going to tell you a little story. When I get through telling you that little story, you're going to understand what an alcoholic personality is. And I'd like to share that little story with you tonight, and if you've heard it, you're going to hear it again. It's the story of a little drunk who was walking along the beach one day, and he found half buried in the sand a bottle. And he picked it up and uncorked it in hopes of finding a few stray drops in the bottom. And instead, when he uncorked the bottle, there was a puff of smoke, and all of a sudden, standing in front of him in the sand was a fellow about 8'11", with a big turban around his head. The little fellow rubbed his eyes. I mean, he's had some bad DTs in his time, but he'd never seen anything like that. It spoke. It said, I am your genie, and I have but to grant you three wishes. What would you like? What is your first wish? The little drunk didn't have to think very long. He said, I'd like a bottle of bourbon that's never empty. Another instant, another puff of smoke, and there in the sand in front of him was a jug, filled right to the top. He uncorked it and sniffed it. Yep, it was good stuff. He turned it up and took a good swig out of it. It tasted great. He tilted it up for about 5 or 6 seconds and chug-a-lugged at it, tilted it down, it was still right to the top. Turned it up for about a minute and a half, most he'd had in a month. He tilted it down, and it's still right to the top. Jeannie said, how's that? He said, that's wonderful. He said, okay, you have two more wishes. What would you like? He said, I want two more just like this one. I'm going to take your inventory just a little bit. If you understood that story, you're in the right place tonight. And I tell you, you go out here on the streets of Helen and the people that are not a part of us, you tell them that story, and they look at you kind of funny, and they say, well, if this one's never going to be, why would it? They don't get it. And I've quit trying to make them get it. I've quit trying to make them understand, because they're not going to understand. When I found you people, you did understand. You understood me. For the first time in my life, I felt that I belonged when I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to explain anymore. When I talked about my hurts, my pains, my fears, you smiled, you nodded, and I knew that you knew. Them, they'll never know, and they'll never understand. My story actually has to go back far beyond my first drink. It has to really go back to my very first recollection as a little kid. Because that feeling I was talking about a moment ago of never fitting in, being scared to death, not belonging, I had that feeling for as long as I could remember, as a little bitty kid. I never felt that I belonged at all. And the people that grew up with me in the little small town across the mountains here in North Georgia would have said, no, that can't be right, because Billy Sanders was a member of everything that came along in school, every club, every organization, every group. That's right. I was. Trying desperately, but never making it. Never feeling that I fit. Never feeling that I belonged. I can remember being at parties with kids, and somehow I could be right at the edge of a circle of people. But I didn't fit. I didn't belong. Scared. I can remember my mom used to send me to the store to get an item, and I'd wander up and down the aisles of the store for 30 minutes if I had to till I found it before I'd stop and ask anybody where it was. So afraid of rejection. When I was 13 years old, I got my first job in the business that I've been in for almost 40 years. That's the broadcasting business. In a little town, I became a disc jockey. Supposedly at that time, the youngest in the country. And that didn't help me make people understand at all, because they assumed that little, Rip called him a loud mouth on the radio that sounded so cocky and self-confident, must have it all together. That was somebody else. That was another personality hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone. Inside was still that scary little boy, crying out for help. When I was 15 years old, I had my first drink of alcohol. I grew up in the little town of Hartwell across the way here, and they used to say on Saturday night in Hartwell there were three things you could do. You could watch them unload the truck at the A&P, you could watch the water tank leak, or you could go across the river into South Carolina and buy and drink beer. Now, I am here to assure you that I did not arrive at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous from too much water tank watching. When I was 15 years old, under peer pressure or curiosity or a combination of both, I went with a group of friends across the old muddy Savannah River into South Carolina. We bought a case of beer and we came back and sat on the banks of the Savannah River. They say sometimes that you ought to go back to where you had your first drink. I'd like to, but I can't. Where I had my first drink is about 150 feet underwater, the bottom of Lake Hartwell. But somebody took a church key and popped open a Pabst Blue Ribbon and handed it to me, and I tilted it up into the great big chug of that stuff. And it was, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most vile, putrid, god-awful, horrible-tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth. I only drank six that night. It was terrible. I remember thinking when I was drinking, how in the world would anybody drink this stuff? Awful. But somewhere between the second and the third drink, something happened. The click. You know what the click is? It goes off right back in here. The click. All of a sudden, all those fears went away. Little Billy Sanders wasn't afraid anymore. And I was smarter, and wittier, and handsomer, and sexier than I had ever been in my life, or anybody else I'd ever known in my life. And I knew I had found a friend for life. I knew I had found a buddy that I was going to have by not very far from me for the rest of my life. And I almost did. I didn't drink that much during high school because most of you that know anything about small towns, there isn't a whole lot of anonymity. And when you have a mother that would just as soon kid you as look at you if she knew you were drinking, you take it easy. But then not very long after that, I graduated from high school. And as Rip told you, went across about 40 miles to Athens, to the big city of Athens, and became a Bulldog fan, and also tasted my first real taste of anonymity, because the student population of the University of Georgia was approximately 2.5 that time of my whole hometown. And nobody cared how much little Billy Sanders drank. So I started drinking every day. It didn't take me very long to discover that liquor was a whole lot quicker, and I put the beer behind me and started into the bottle. One of the things I liked about being in social situations and seeing people drink liquor, I'd see somebody with a fancy glass and a few ice cubes in it, and this clear liquid and olives and little onions and lemons and peels bobbing around in there. And I said, that's class. Man, that's classy. That's how I want to be. That's how I'm going to drink. And that comes back up in my story a little bit later on that I'll share with you. I rocked along through college. There are many, many people who talk about their great memories of their college career. Unfortunately, I don't have a tremendous number of great memories of my college career. A lot of it's very foggy and very hazy. I was back over for homecoming this past few weeks ago at the University of Georgia, and it brought back some memories. It also brought back some blanks that I still haven't filled in. I had an experience just a couple of weeks ago. I was doing a radio program in Atlanta, a fundraiser for one of the local public stations. And someone called into the radio program to make a donation to the public radio station and told one of the phone operators, I think that man on the air was my college roommate at Georgia. And I said, she came over on the next break and told me. And I said, well, chances are it probably isn't. There were three Bill Sanders at the university when I was there, and heaven knows how many there have been through the years. But he said, well, he's going to call back. I said, well, get his name. And on the next break, he called back, and the operator came over and told me the guy's name, and I went, oh, my God. It was my college roommate when I was a freshman at the University of Georgia. And the day before yesterday, he and I went out and had lunch together, the first time I've seen him in 30 years. And it was a great reunion. But he reminded me of some of those blanks. He reminded me how about half the year when I'd come in drunk and fall down on the floor, he managed to heft me up and pull and tug and shove. He was a tall, skinny kid. He managed to get me into my bunk and get me to covered up. And he said about the last two, 3 months of the year, the last quarter of the year, he said, I'd come in, fall down the floor, pass out drunk. He said, to hell with him. You stay there. And I'd stay there and wake up there the next morning. I didn't remember that. I told him, I said, you make a great alimony. I can't understand that, but that's all right. All through my college career, I drank and got into a tremendous amount of trouble, and I won't go into those war stories. Suffice it to say, Dean Bill Tate, the dean of men's university, had a bench that sat right outside the door of his office that got to be known as the Bill Sanders bench. But I sat on it more than anybody else. And it wasn't waiting to just stop, pop in and say hi either. Usually I had been sent for. I was in a situation a few days ago talking to the president of the University of Georgia and pointing out that I felt cheated by the university in one way. For those of you who went to Georgia, you know that after ball games they ring the chapel bell, and they have a roster of the official chapel bell ringers at the University of Georgia. All through the years, you can look back into the early days of this century and you can see the list of those who rang the bells after what game. And I told President Chuck Knapp the other day when I saw him, I said, I feel cheated because I am one of the bell ringers of the chapel bell at the University of Georgia. My name is not in the roster. I feel cheated. Of course, it could have had something to do with the fact that I didn't ring it after a ball game. I rang it at 3 o'clock in the morning on Easter Sunday. And it wasn't Dean Bill Tate that came to greet me. It was the mayor of Athens. And he wasn't smiling. Dean Tate came later. That's the way my college career rocked along. I missed a lot of classes. I missed a lot of life. But when I was in my junior year, I got the dream of every kid in the broadcasting school at the University of Georgia, an opportunity to do a summer internship at the big 50,000-watt clear channel Voice of the South, WSB, in Atlanta. It was a dream come true, more than I could have ever hoped for in my life. Two internships were given that year, and out of the several hundred that applied, those two went to my roommate and me. And on a spring day of that year, we borrowed a car from a friend. Neither of us had one, and we journeyed the 65 or 70 miles to Athens to find a place to live and put down a deposit and to go to the station and meet the people that we'd be working with that summer. They were all stars to us, and stars were in our eyes. And we spent the day in Atlanta dreaming, excited, top of the world. Kept thinking, you know, life can't get any better than this. We went and had a few drinks and a few more drinks and a few more drinks to celebrate, and then finally took the car back to Athens to the friend we borrowed it from, and in his apartment decided to have a few more drinks and celebrate, because like I said, it don't get any better than this. And as I began to clown around, as I was prone to do by then, and act like a total idiot when I was drinking, I reached up on the wall in my friend's apartment and took down an old antique 22 long-barrel pistol and a big collection of guns he had and waved it around, pointed at my roommate and said, "Stick 'em up," acting like Matt Dillon. He threw his hands up in mock surrender and I pulled the trigger. There was a sound like thunder. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. A few hours later, at a local hospital, they were to tell us that Wayne would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. Strange thing happened in the hospital room that night in Athens in the early hours of that morning, the next morning. My roommate reached up from the hospital bed and put his hand on my arm. He said, "Bill, please don't blame yourself for this. I know it was an accident. It could just as easily have been the other way. Please don't blame yourself." He forgave me immediately, but I didn't forgive me for more than 20 years. For 20 years, I used it as an excuse to crawl in the bottle and live, to beat myself up and pull myself down. I went on that summer to the internship in Atlanta. My roommate spent the summer in Piedmont Hospital in surgery after surgery in vain attempt to try to restore the use of his legs. Unfortunately, it was not to happen. My pattern of working that summer, to get up in about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that dark little apartment, and get dressed and go to work at 3. I would work right through the 11 o'clock news at night, and we'd get off the 11 o'clock news at 11:30. Several of us would go across the street to what was then the old Riviera in Atlanta, and we'd call into that bar, and we'd drink until they closed, and usually there were enough of us, media, radio and TV and newspaper people, and in there they just kind of locked the door and leave one bartender and let us stay. We drink till 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Stumble out of there into a cab, back to that dark little apartment, sleep it off. Next day, same thing. Over and over and over. The summer that was to have been the dream of a lifetime, the greatest experience of my life, is today but a foggy, hazy nightmare. But as long as I could keep that cycle going, I'd be okay. Finally, that fall, I went back to school to finish my senior year at Georgia. It all came crumbling down. And I hadn't been back in school more than a couple of weeks when I set a plan into motion. I started going to the infirmary at the university and asking for sleeping pills, saying I was having trouble sleeping. And they had 3 doctors at the infirmary, and I'd go to one day and then wait a couple of days and go back and go to another doctor and another day. And they'd all give me a prescription, take them down the hall to the university pharmacy, fill them, and take them home. Tucked them into the nightstand of my dormitory room and waited. Finally, a few weeks later, when my new roommate was headed home one Friday afternoon for the weekend to show his family the new car he'd bought, I stood at the dormitory window and I watched as his car pulled out of the parking lot and up Lumpkin Street and out of sight. And I put my plan into motion. I sat down on the side of the bed and poured out what was later to be determined to be between 60 and 70 sleeping pills on the nightstand. One by one and two by two, popped them in and swallowed them down. Closed the blinds, turned out the light, pulled up the cover, and went to sleep. And for more than 20 years, I thought it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's car broke down at the city limits of Athens. Brand new car, and had to be towed back. I thought it was a huge coincidence that he came back into that dormitory room and saw all those little bottles and saw the state I was in, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, put it all together real quickly, and called the ambulance. I say I thought it was a coincidence because I don't believe in coincidences anymore. I love the definition I heard a few years ago that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And I believe with all my heart that that was the first of many, many, many times in this alcoholic's life when the God that you've helped me to come to know and understand looked down and said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." And I don't know for what purpose I'm still here, because by all rights, with all of the wrecked cars and all of the insane behavior and the wild and crazy places I found myself in during my drinking years, I cannot imagine why I'm still here. But I do believe with all my heart that if I keep showing up in these rooms and hanging around you people, and one day at a time staying sober, that I may be in the right place at the right time for whatever God's will is for me. They took me to the hospital that day, and they pumped out my stomach, and then I began the great American tradition of visiting the neighborhood shrink. And I absolutely could not begin to tell you how many of those individuals that I've visited through the years how much money went out from me and from my family paying those people. And every time I would go to one of them and walk out of the office, I'd walk out damning and cursing him. Because he didn't help me one damn bit. Now, this is a program of rigorous honesty. So therefore, I must share with you that I think that there is at least the slight remote possibility that one or more of those shrinks might have been able to help me if I had ever once told the truth. But you know, if you've ever been to one of those people, somewhere around the third or fourth question, they invariably ask you, do you think you might have a drinking problem? And my standard answer was, no, I drink fine. And they'd go off treating something else. Spent a lot of time with those people. I finally did exit the University of Georgia, and as I told the president the other day, I have never been completely sure whether or not I earned a diploma or if they got tired of me hanging around over there and just gave me one. I am not about to ask because I've gotten it used to hanging around the house for the last 30 years and kind of like the way it looks, and I'm going to keep it. I'm not going to ask whether I deserve it or not. I ended up just down the road from here in Gainesville, Georgia. Went to work at the radio station there. Decided after I got out of college that I need to get my act together, clean up my act, try to act like an adult, be more responsible. Got a good job, joined the church, joined the local civic clubs, got involved in scout work, joined the local fraternal order that had one of the only bars in town, joined everything there was. And guess which one got the most of my attention? The bar. Didn't take long till I was in that place every night. Before too long, I hadn't been in the town but a few months until I was asked to go on a blind date and met a beautiful young girl. Immediately fell in love. I knew because of my lifestyle that if I was going to make a difference in this girl's life and want her to be interested in being around my life, that I better clean up my act, get myself together, and cut down on my drinking. But much to my pleasant surprise, I discovered that woman liked to drink just as much as I did. I didn't have to cut out on anything. We dated for about 7 months, and then for 8 months, and along the way I asked her to marry me. And in December of that year, she became my first wife. And we had a pattern. Every night we'd go to the club. As soon as we get through work in the afternoon, she'd get off her job, I'd get off my job, we'd get in the car, head out to the club, and we'd sit down and start drinking. Once, twice a week, we'd even have dinner while we were there. We'd stay till they closed the place about 1 or 1:30 in the morning, and we'd go home, crash in the bed, get up the next morning, and go to work. Now, most people, when they get up and go to work in the morning and they've been drinking the night before, the person at the next desk or maybe the person across the hall might have some idea that you had kind of a rough night last night by the way you kind of moved and talked. It's not that way when you got to sign a radio station on the air. Folks, I'm going to tell you, you try to sound cheerful and happy and wake up all of North Georgia when you're hungover, it's hell. When your mouth tastes like the bottom of a bird cage, and when your head feels like a whole Russian army did maneuvers on it last night. It was back then that I first learned how to pray. I'd get the first record started and turn the microphone off and turn that music down, and I'd lean over and I'd say, oh dear God, thank you that this ain't television. I would never have pulled it off. My first wife and I lived in those bars, though, in and out all the time. And then one day she came home and said, we're going to have a child. And of course, we were both thrilled. And we talked a lot about it and thought we need to cut down on our drinking, get our act together and learn how to be real parents. And when that baby came, we did. We cleaned up our act and we stayed out of those bars for several weeks. And then we discovered the great American institution called the babysitter. We turned the child over to the neighborhood kid, and we were out and gone again. And it rocked along in that way, and I know now, looking back then, is when the marriage began to come apart at the seams. It was then that it all became unglued. I've heard people in this program talk about that people that, when they have marital troubles as a result of alcoholism, they always said that, you know, the main basis of the problem was communication problems. They didn't communicate. I never did understand that because my wife and I communicated. I mean, you could ask our neighbors four doors down the street, and they'd tell you the Sanders communicate. They could usually even tell you what it was we were communicating about. And our communication session usually followed a particular pattern. We'd get started on Sunday afternoon. That's a good time to do it because we've got a long time to, you know, air it all out. We'd launch into a discussion and get about 15 or 20 minutes into it. I could hang in there with the best of them until it became apparent that I was on the losing end of that discussion. And when it became apparent I was on the losing end of that discussion, my pattern always followed. I'd grab my bottle, storm out the back door, slam it, get in the car, peel out of the driveway, up the hill. I'm out of here. I don't have to stay here and take this. Over and over and over and over again, happened like that. One Sunday afternoon in particular that's very memorable, we got into one of our communication sessions. And about 10 minutes into it, it became abundantly apparent that I was definitely on the losing end of it. So I grabbed my bottle, stormed out the back door, slammed it, got in my car, peeled up the driveway, up the street. I'm out of here. I am not going to stay here and listen to this, just like 100 times before. Only thing different this particular Sunday afternoon, I still had my pajamas on. Well, my wife did what any sweet, loving, thoughtful, caring wife would do. She called a friend to come get me and bring me home. The only thing wrong with that is the friend happened to be a police captain. And he found me sitting in the parking lot of the Holiday Inn, minding my own business, sitting there talking to my bottle. And he came up and tapped on the car window. I looked up at him, "Hey, Harold." Well, Captain Harold began to talk to me about getting in the car with him and him taking me home, and I told him that he could. I told him, "No, thank you." And and then he began to talk to me about his relative size to mine and his Marine Corps career and the impact that the billy club hanging on his side made when pressed up to the side of a human head. And the more he talked, the more it began to make sense I might want to consider going with him. I was drunk. I wasn't stupid. Yet. Well, I got out of my car and got in the police car with him, and we took off, and it wasn't but about two turns. I also wasn't so drunk, I knew we were not headed toward my house. And about two more turns, I knew where we were headed because we pulled into the emergency room parking lot of what was then Hall County Hospital. And before I could blink, he turned around, opened the car door, took me out of the car, led me inside. Before I could say 1, 2, 3, I was upstairs checked into a room. Folks, I'm going to tell you, you won't believe how fast you can get checked in a hospital room when you already got your pajamas on. Most hospitals have got this thing about drunks sitting in the lobby with vodka bottles in their hands in pajamas. And it was during that little stay in the hospital that I got my first taste of what real undeniable denial is. Because you see, that Sunday afternoon, my wife and my doctor and minister and attorney and friends and two or three people I think they brought in off the street had what today we would call a group conscience. And they decided Bill's notorious in town. Everybody knows him. Everybody in North Georgia knows who he is. The newspapers would love to get hold of the fact that he's in here in the drunk tank, detoxing. So why don't we put him up in the regular part of the hospital and we'll hang a clipboard on the door that says he has strep throat and we can detox him up there just as well as we can down here. So they did. And when I checked out of the hospital some days later, I thanked all the nurses and doctors for the outstanding work they'd done. My throat felt fine. And proceeded to go home that night and get drunk. And you know, the truth and the honesty of that night didn't, or that hospital stay did not come out until I sat down with a pencil and paper to write the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's when the truth finally came out. Because I had told the story, believed it so many times, that that's what I was in that hospital for, was a strep throat. It wasn't too terribly long after that we decided we would do the great American alcoholic cure and move to Atlanta. And we did. Lock, stock, and barrel, and baby, we moved to Atlanta. And you know, people in this program said talk about losing their homes and things like that. And I said, I had a real bad case of I nevers when I came to this fellowship. I never had this happen, never had that happen. My sponsor was positive I was going to die of terminal uniqueness. Alcoholism didn't get me first. One of the I nevers that I had was that I had never lost a home, like so many people said it happened to them. It wasn't again until I started writing that fourth step and I found out, oh yes, we had lost a home. Because we had a nice, very nice home in Gainesville, and we sold it, and we moved to Atlanta, and we said, we're going to do something very smart. We're going to move into an apartment, and we're going to take our time looking around to see what house we want to buy and what part of Atlanta we want to live in. We don't want to jump into anything too quick and don't want to do anything hasty. Well, we didn't do anything hasty. We lived in an apartment for 16 years, and we drank up every dime of the equity out of that house. And those apartments we lived in, some of them weren't, I wouldn't want to live in them again. After we moved to Atlanta, I got involved in part of the broadcasting business that I've been in since then. It involved a thing called public relations. And, I didn't even know what public relations was. You know, the little town of Hartwell where I came from, you didn't have relations in public. I've been at it for almost 20 years now, and I'm still not real sure what it is, but one part of it that I took to right quick was a thing called a free martini lunch. I liked five better, but if you wanted to have three, that was your business. And I also discovered something else that we didn't have in the little towns where I'd lived before. It's called happy hour. That was where you go in and sit down at a bar and you order one drink and pay for one drink. And they bring you two drinks, sometimes three drinks. I mean, the way I drank, there was a lot of times I saw two and three sitting in front of me, but I'm talking about this is when they really put them there. And I also discovered that if you took those 3 to 5 martini lunches and you stretched them a little long and you went to the happy hour a little early, you kind of pushed the two together and you didn't even have to go back to work in the afternoon. I also discovered that, actually I didn't discover the fact that it suited my staff that worked for me just fine that I didn't come back in the afternoon. Because you see, the person that came to work in the morning that they worked for could be a pretty nice guy. But the one that came back from lunch was sometimes argumentative, critical, forgetful, abusive, surly, and downright mean. You see, that best friend that I had met on the banks of the Savannah River had begun to turn on me. But he did it ever so subtly because I didn't know it. I didn't notice what was going on around me. That best buddy of mine didn't want me to know. I didn't notice that I had a little girl who was now 4 or 5 and turning on 6 years old. I didn't notice that she didn't invite friends home to spend the night anymore. She never knew when Dad's going to come home in the middle of the night drunk, slamming doors, smashing furniture, putting his foot through the television set, dragging her out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and demanding that she do some insane thing like clean up her room at 3 a.m. I didn't notice that the only look in her eyes was one of fear and of hate and of disgust. I didn't notice that she avoided me every opportunity that she had. Oh, the next morning, I would be reminded of what I had done the night before and what had happened. My wife had a very good memory and was very open about describing to me what I had done in great detail. And I would always feel tremendous remorse and guilt. And I began the pattern way back then of taking my little girl by the hand and saying, come on, sweetheart, let's go take a walk. Karen and I would walk out of the apartment down the sidewalk, and we'd walk, and I would look down at her, and I'd say, sweetheart, Mom told me what I did last night. I don't really remember it, but she told me I was pretty mean and pretty hateful, and I said some nasty things to you, and I screamed and yelled at you. But I want you to listen to me right now. I'm going to promise you that it's never, ever, ever, ever going to happen again. And my friend that I met on the banks of the Savannah River didn't allow me to see that there was not even a glimmer of belief in that little girl's eyes. She'd heard that story too many times. She'd heard too many apologies. She wasn't buying it for a minute. My life with alcohol rocked along, and it went further and further down. More and more, I didn't come home to that first wife of mine and It didn't bother her because she was off drinking in her places and I would be off drinking in my places, and so many times that little girl would be home alone in that dark apartment by herself. And that little girl learned the telephone numbers of probably a dozen or more bars in Atlanta. It was not unusual for me to be sitting at a bar at 11 o'clock at night and the phone would ring at the bar and the bartender would answer it. He'd turn around and look at me with a look of disgust and say, "It's your kid." And I'd take the phone and she'd say, "Daddy, please come home." And I'd say, "Where's your mother?" She'd say, "I don't know. Please come home, Daddy, I'm scared." And I'll say, "Honey, I'm going to have one more drink and then I promise you I'll be straight home." And I don't need to tell you the rest of the story. 6 drinks later and 4 hours later, I'd stumble into that department, walk into that little bedroom, and there, huddled in the corner of the bed, would be that little girl, crying, trembling. Did I get the message? No. My friend in the bottle was still hanging on. My wife and I were going in opposite directions. The marriage was already long, long gone. I think we both knew it. So we didn't ask where each other was going when we'd leave. We didn't ask where each other had been when we came back because we didn't care. And I began staying out more and more nights, not even coming home at all. My wife didn't even ask where I was when I'd come in the next day or the next. And I began waking up in strange beds with strange people in strange cities. And I began having to look at telephone books and nightstands of motels to figure out what town it was I was in. And I would sit down with credit card receipts and try to put them in chronological order to find out where I'd been the last 4 or 5 days. More and more blackouts, lost periods of time. Finally, one evening, I'm sitting in my recliner chair at home, watching nothing on television, drinking. My wife leaves, and I don't care where she's going. 3 or 4 hours later, she comes walking back in, and she stands in front of me and looks down at me in my recliner chair and says, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, "Who gives a... who cares?" And she didn't say anything. She did something really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, y'all know where she's been. She's been to an AA meeting. Now, I told that little story some months ago at an AA conference in Fargo, Moorhead, North Dakota, and they got this strange look on their face and look back and forth at each other, and I found out they don't do chips up there like we do. So I had to kind of come back and explain to what happened. But y'all know where she's been. And she told me. And I absolutely went into a flying, flute perfect rage because I knew that there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. Because if she was an alcoholic, then it meant she couldn't be. I mean, it's impossible. That didn't stop her. She started going to those meetings every day, sometimes 2 a day. Something about 90 and 90 and 90, some crap was all put in her head. Story actually went back earlier than that. My wife had originally, about 2 years before that, gone to an Al-Anon meeting to find out what to do with that drunk at home. The only thing wrong with that is she went to the Al-Anon meeting, crocked to the gills. And they ticked her off by suggesting that she might be in the wrong room. So she left for 2 years and then came back that night and went to the right room. Well, she started going to those meetings and I continued to stay away from home as at all possible costs. And things began to change. I couldn't quite figure out what in the world was going on. All of a sudden, she wouldn't fight anymore. And I'd get in the middle of an argument, or actually, I'd get all set for an argument. I'd have all of my arguments and all of my facts and figures lined up and ready to go. I'd got this one licked. I'd launch into the argument. She'd look at me and go, turn around and walk off. You people were getting to her. Well, my drinking went further and further down, and my life continued to fall apart. You remember I said earlier about how I like the class of the fancy crystal glasses and the fancy bars and olives and all that good stuff? Well, I'm going to tell you something. When you wake up and you look down and realize there's dew all over your clothes and you figure out where you are and you realize you're under a bush in Piedmont Park in downtown Atlanta. In the scene before your eyes, you realize you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse. Folks, there ain't no class in that. And I decided a long time ago that there's also no good comeback answer when he says, "What are you doing down there?" I've had 12, 13 years trying to think of some good line I could come back to that cop with. I still hadn't thought of one. There's no class when you're spread eagle over the trunk of a police car. You're handcuffed and hauled off with a blood alcohol level of 0.28 and higher. There were more walks with my little girl, and more empty promises, and more total disbelief from her. By now she was 12 years old, and she'd heard every story there was. My wife continued going to those meetings, and I'll give it to her credit. She did not try to get me to go with her. She didn't try to put any of that AA bunk on me. Oh, I mean, there were little hints around the house, like I'd go in the bathroom, lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works, taped to the, you know. Stick my arm under the pillow to go to sleep at night. She knew exactly how I slept. I'd stick my arm under the pillow, and there's a piece of paper there, and I pull it out. It's that little pamphlet with all them questions on it. I'd get about the third question and go, "I don't need to read this crap," and throw it. But things kept changing. Finally, on the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. I mean, the last full week gone. No total blank as to what had happened. When I came out of that blackout drunk, I'm sitting in that same old recliner chair, and in my right hand there is an empty bottle. And in the other hand, there is a loaded, cocked 22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. Some months earlier than that, my wife had come to me one afternoon, and she said, "I want you to go to an AA meeting with me tonight." I went, "Oh, no." She said, "I'm picking up a 90-day chip, and I'd like for you to be there." We argued back and forth, and there were some tears, and finally I said, "Okay, I'm going to go, but I'm going to set the conditions." Always, you know, set the conditions. Nobody paid attention to them, but I always set them. She said, "What?" I said, "I'm going in my own car." You know, she'd go to these meetings and stay gone 2 or 3 hours. She always said after the meeting they'd go to Coco's and have coffee. Well, I didn't know where it was she was going. I wasn't buying that line. I was going somewhere to drink coffee 10 o'clock at night. But where it was, I wasn't going. I said, "Well, where's this place we're going?" She said, "It's called the 8111 Club. It's just a couple of miles from here." So I said, "Okay, I'll follow you." I got in my car and I followed her and went down Roswell Road and got down to this one place, and we made a left turn up the driveway. And I'd seen this little, it's a little house sitting up on the hill in the trees, pretty little house. And I had passed that place almost every day on my way home from the bar. And I had always thought, someday I need to get to know the guy that lives there, because he obviously has a party every night. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. I walked into that meeting room through a sliding glass door at the back of the room, sat down behind the post way on the back row. For the next hour, I witnessed the biggest bunch of lunatics I had ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff at the first of the meeting, and then some guy raised his hand and told everybody in the room that he'd gotten 3 DUIs. And everybody in the room cracked up. Another guy said he got 5 DUIs and was arrested for indecent exposure. They came unglued. And the more I listened to them, the more I thought if they'd heard some of the things that had happened to me, I could sound like Richard Pryor in here. But seriously, the thing that struck me that night, the thought that went through my mind that night, is don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They've got nothing to laugh about. That's ironic, because today I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. There's healing and there's magic and there's power in that laughter. And I love it. And I think we need to do more of it. But that night it didn't compute. Well, that meeting rattled on for an hour, and finally, at the end of the meeting, everybody stood up and I started for the door, and then they grabbed me by the hand from both sides. And they said the only thing that was familiar to me that whole night, and that was the Lord's Prayer. And I got to the end of that, I started out that door across that parking lot. I was getting out of that loony bin. And I got about two-thirds of the way toward my car across that parking lot, and something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vise. It spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man that was 7'11". I know today he's only 6'6", but he looked a lot taller that night. I also remembered him from the meeting. I mean, I'd had a few drinks before I went. I wasn't going to that thing and not fortified. But I'd remembered this guy, because everybody else in the room had said, "My name's Tom, or I'm an alcoholic, or my name's Mary, and I'm an alcoholic, or my name's Sam." This guy was different. He had introduced himself by saying, "My name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk." Give me a break. And this guy gets talking to me about drinking moonshine up here in the mountains, and I'm going, "God, what is he doing? He don't even know who I am." Found out later he knew exactly who I was, because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. And he talked on and on, and he got to talking about drinking moonshine in the mountains in the wintertime and falling down, his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, remember, I'd had martinis that afternoon at the Diplomat in downtown Atlanta, and this guy in overalls is talking to me about... I finally got in my car, and I got home, and I walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, "Don't open your mouth." Because, you see, standing there in that parking lot, Floyd is talking and talking. People come out and get in their cars, and they're going, and they're leaving, you know. Remember, I went in my car so I could get out of here. My wife comes out, goes, "Bye," gets in her car and leaves, and it's me and Floyd. I told my wife that night after I went through about that much booze after I got home, "Don't ever try to get me to go back to one of those meetings," and she didn't. But that afternoon of July 26, 1982, when I came out of that week-long blackout drunk, and I looked down at that pistol and that bottle, all of the pain, all of the fear, all of the hatred of self, all came crashing in one huge moment. And the thought that was going through my mind was, "Is this all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, you can have it." And through the fog of that night, through the pain of that twilight afternoon, there came a voice. The voice of God? No, not directly. The voice of an angel? Well, probably. But it was the voice of an angel through a hillbilly drunk named Floyd. Because in the quiet of that afternoon, as I sat there looking at that gun, at that bottle, one line that Floyd had said to me came through the haze. One sentence cut through the fog of the final moments of alcoholism. And the words that I remembered were, "When I come to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out." On the afternoon of July 26, 1982, could be any closer to hell on this earth, I hope that I never know what it is. I love that old hillbilly drunk named Floyd. He's become a dear friend. I'm thrilled to get to give him his 7 and 8 and 9 year chip. But I got up out of that chair that evening, and I went to the bathroom and cleaned myself up as well as I could and got my car and drove a couple of miles back to that little 8111 club. And I went up that driveway and in that sliding glass door and sat down behind that same post and peeked around it at the front of the room. And folks, don't tell me that God doesn't have a sense of humor. Because there, sitting in front of that room, chairing that meeting, was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man stood up and he talked about those chips. And when he asked if anyone wanted a white chip, I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life. And I walked to the front of that room, and he pressed into a trembling, sweaty palm a white chip, and I closed my hand around it. And I choose to believe that the old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, that a new one walked away. Because by the grace of God and the loving, tender care and people like you in rooms like this, I've not it necessary to take a drink since that night, and that's a miracle. I know that it is not of my doing, because I had quit 1,000 times before. But that night, the only thing I could feel in that room, I didn't remember anything anybody said, still couldn't tell you who said what or what was shared. But I walked out of that room that night with one thing. Hope. Hope. He told me right away that I needed to get a sponsor. And I decided to do it like I had most things in my life, systematically and scientifically. And I looked around to find the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head and tell me that I was a good boy and that I would work in the steps better than anybody he'd ever seen in his life. And I looked around for quite a while, and I finally found just the right person. He was rolier-polier than I am, and snow-white hair and beautiful smile. And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. In the years Doc Crandall was my sponsor, I don't remember him ever telling me one single thing I wanted to hear. But he told me an awful lot of what I need to hear. He started off the first day I knew I was in trouble. He started off, he said, the first thing you do every morning when you get up is you get down on your knees and you ask your God to keep you sober today. And I said, well, Doc, I've been around here a few weeks and I know this God stuff's important in this program. I grew up in church, even taught a Sunday school class one time. I know I need to get back to prayer and all that, but I just got to really be honest with you. I'm not too comfortable with that knee business. He said, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. I said, get down there. And I was still pretty wet behind the ears and cocky. I said, Doc, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He said, Bill, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how our relationship started. He gave me that book and said, I want you to go home and I want you to read the first five chapters of this book. I want you to read it thoroughly and go all the way through it. And I want you to figure out how you can make it work in your life. And then when you get through reading it, you and I are going to sit down and talk. I said, all right, I can get into that now. So I went to the office supply store, and I got me some real sharp pencils and two or three legal pads and a couple of those highlighters, and I went home, and I cleared off the desk and spread all that stuff out, and I went through that book. I was writing and highlighting and underlining, and I marked out the steps that didn't have anything to do with me, and I jotted down the things that I thought of that y'all hadn't, and I had about 20 pages of notes. And I got through several weeks later, and I called Doc. I said, I've been through all this stuff, and I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. And I got in my car, and I went over to his house, and he cleared off sections of the coffee table, and I laid all my stuff out, and I spread it out, opened up the book, opened up my notes, got it all ready. He said, lay it on me. I said, okay, looking at this first step here, Doc, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got. He said, big boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. I said, I know, Doc, but what I think it means is, he said, Bill, look real close, and you'll see it's written in English. It says what it means. That's the way I work my way through the steps, folks. And I made a big, bad mistake somewhere along about 6-7 months into it. It suddenly occurred to me I was whizzing right along through these steps. I was going to be through them things before I knew it. And I said, fell into his favorite trap. Doc, tell me, what do you do when you get through working these steps? I'll never forget his answer. I hope I don't. He said, you lay real still because you're dead. Either way. Kicking and scratching, sometimes screaming, he worked me through those steps. He reminded me from time to time that they had put little numbers by it for smart college boys like me so we could keep up with them. He ingrained in my head that they were not multiple choice. I still didn't quite understand what your motives were. I didn't understand what was in it for you. I mean, all the hugging and the sharing, but I couldn't quite figure out why you cared. in it for you. There must be another book that I was going to get later. I didn't understand it. Finally, one afternoon, Doc told me, planned to stay after the meeting tonight. As we were going into the meeting, planned to stay after the meeting tonight. There's a fellow here with a similar background to yours. He did the first meeting. I want you to share with him a little bit after the meeting. I said, gosh, Doc, I really would like to, but I've had a rough day today. I hadn't had a bite to eat yet, and I've got a headache. Catch me another time. He said, you don't understand. You're staying after the meeting, and we're going to talk. I knew that tone of voice. I said, yes, sir. I said, I can stay about 15, 20 minutes, but I am going to have to get home, because I'm hungry. Meeting was over at 9. About 11:15, I was on my way home. And I pulled off the side of the road with tears streaming down my face. Because I got it. I suddenly realized the headache was gone. I'd forgotten about being hungry. And for those couple of hours, this self-centered, egotistical drunk had gotten out of himself and thought more about another human being than he did his own selfish needs and wants. Magnificent. Never felt anything like it in my life. And I ran home and I grabbed the phone and I called Doc. He'd had time to get home. And I started babbling into the phone and he started saying something about sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And I got to talking to him about this is fantastic. It feels wonderful now. I know why you go on so many 12-step calls and what it's all about. I said, Doc, there's people in hospitals and there's people in jails and there's people... And then he started talking to me about Easy Does It. One of the things that Doc admonished me about, and everyone that he sponsored and everyone he shared with, he said, if you get into an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you're going to lose. You can't win. Over and over I heard him say it. If you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you will lose. It can't be a subject for discussion. And I heard it here, but I didn't hear it in here. It had been just a few months, and I had to go on my first business trip out of town to Washington, D.C. And I fortified myself with a meeting that morning and lunch with my sponsor, and that afternoon out at the Hartsfield International Airport, and my plane hadn't cleared the ground until the meeting started up here in my head. 800 miles from home, nobody up there knows you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. You can tie one on tonight, and the time you come home Friday, it'll all be out of you. You notice I didn't say you can have a drink tonight. I don't understand the concept of a drink. I mean, what good is a drink? I don't recall ever having a drink in my life. I mean, if I'm going to have a drink, it better be a real big drink. Like bucket size. I still don't understand people that do that. There's a part of me, you know, I'm sober almost 11 and a half years, and I'm occasionally still in a restaurant. I'll be sitting and having a business lunch, and I look over at some guy over there at the next table, orders a drink and brings it, and he spends half the lunch stirring it with his finger and sipping it out of it and talking and business, and they order food, and he eats the food and gets through, and he gets up and pays the check, walks out the door, and half that drink still sitting there. There's a part of me that still wants to chase him out in the parking lot and say, get back in there and finish that drink and order another one. But all the way to Washington that afternoon, that meeting's going on in my head. Yes, no, you can, you can't, you should, you shouldn't. Nobody will know. Yes, they will. You'll know. Back and forth. I even looked around that plane to see if other people were hearing that meeting going on. They didn't seem to. The plane touched down at National Airport in Washington, out of the plane, into a cab, headed across the 14th Street Bridge into Washington. The meeting still raging. We pulled up in front of the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill, and I got out of that cab and in the door. And the radar, boing, there's the bar. Way across that big atrium lobby. I got radar, you know, we can spot them where they are. Hide them. We find them. Took less than 10 minutes to check into my room, dump my bags upstairs, come back down, and I stood in the doorway of that bar for 4 or 5 minutes as the meeting played out up here. And Doc's admonition of if you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you're going to lose, was nowhere in sight. And I lost. And after standing there for several minutes, I walked over and sat down at the bar, and the bartender came and stood in front of me, looked down, smiled, sat and stood there for just a couple of seconds. He said, something really weird. He said, hey, buddy, how about a Coke? I said, what? He pointed and said, I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing, that's what you'd want. I had forgotten to take off this damned AA pin. set that coat down, and goes down the bar, waits on two or three people, and comes back and stands in front of me. I'm still sitting there staring at that coke. He said, "You ain't got any business in here, do you?"
"No."
He said, "Where you belong is three blocks down the street, upstairs over the furniture store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." And I went to that meeting that night. I've been back to that meeting a number of times. I did two other things that night. I came back into a bar and I thanked an angel in a bartender's clothes. Another one of those coincidences. He smiled and looked at me and said, "You weren't in any real danger in my bar." He said, "I saw you stand there in the door so long, I thought you were looking for somebody. But when you sat down, I saw that pen, and I saw that sweat on your face. I knew what you were doing, and there's no way in hell you were getting a drink out of me tonight." And the other thing I did that night is I got down on my knees beside a hotel room bed in our nation's capital. And I said, "God, if you've gone to this much trouble to keep me sober tonight, I will never test you again." And I haven't. I stay out of bars because I've got no business there. I don't belong in bars. I belong in rooms like this with people like you. You understand me? They don't. I'm going to tell you folks that over 20 years of drinking, I never had one single bartender tell me, "You keep coming back and it'll get better." I remember Doc, one night in a meeting, a young man said he was going to a bar in Atlanta that night. And Doc said, "What are you going to a bar for?" He said, "We're going to hear the band." He said, "Buy their record." Kid said, "They hadn't got one." "Then they're not any good." He's a tough old goat. On November 25th, 1985, my sponsor, Doc Crandall, went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man shared with a young drunk that Doc had been working with for several years to try to get sober, the young man was suicidal, and the other man and Doc struggled to take a shotgun away from the boy. Shotgun discharged. Doc died on the way to the hospital. In the late hours of that afternoon in Doc's home, as I watched the sun go down, I never felt the loneliness like I felt that night. I said, "How can I possibly stay sober without the man by my side who led me through those steps, who shared with me so much of what this program is about? How can I go without him?" In the stillness of that twilight, the answer came. You do it by doing the things he taught you to do. And that his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him. All the way back to that little gatehouse in Accra in 1935 when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor said, "Do you think we might be able to stay sober if we help one another?" My granddaddy's sponsor, who died just a couple of years ago, after 40 years of sobriety in this program, after 9 days after his 40th birthday, he was fond of saying, and I believe it with all my heart, that in 1935, God in his infinite loving wisdom looked down and said, "The lowly alcoholic has suffered long enough. I must give him a way out." And what a way he could have given us. We could, as many of us should have been, locked away. We could have been put away in prisons or insane asylums. We could have been locked up as hopeless outcasts, as most of us were chiseling a lifestyle for ourselves. But look at the way he gave us. He gave us each other. And more love than most of us had ever known in our lives. And more caring and sharing and laughter and fun and fellowship. And then he topped it off with a closer relationship with him than most of us had ever known, or that most people on this earth will never know. That's why I say we are the luckiest people on the face of this earth. And I am very thankful to be an alcoholic because of the gifts that I'm given every day. During those days after Doc's death, I was surrounded by the most wonderful bunch of sponsorees that anybody's ever known. And those kids gathered around me and they loved me and they nursed me. They carried me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They made me share when I wanted to isolate. And they took care of me until I could take care of myself again. In a large way, they still take care of me. I came to AA with a resentment about young people even being around. These snot-nosed kids couldn't have been drank like I did. What are they doing here? God has a sense of humor. He plays tricks because he made us like that. And I work with a lot of young boys, and I love them to death. They won't let me get old. They won't let me think old or act old. Sometimes they wear me out, but one of them that came along about 6 years ago carved such a niche in our lives that he ended up coming home with us, and he became a son to us and lived with us for 4.5 years. He just moved out a couple of months ago, and we're so proud of him we can hardly stand it. 2 weeks ago, he celebrated 7 years clean and sober. Most of the time, you can't wipe the smile off his face. God's been so good to us. I talk long, but I want to share with you in closing that on the 15th day of February of last year, I took one more walk with my little girl. This time, it was down the aisle of a church. And oh, God, did she look beautiful that afternoon, that long, white, beautiful gown. She looked like a princess. There at the front of the church stood the handsome young man, the prince that was to become my little girl's husband. And I thought back in the moments as we stood in the ante room of that church of the gifts that God had given us. You see, I referred in my talk to that woman I used to be married to as my first wife. Because you see, I'm not married to the same woman anymore. Thank God she's not married to the same man anymore either. We're the same people, same bodies, a lot healthier. On December 30th of 1982 would have been our 16th wedding anniversary, and divorce papers were to have been signed. But instead, in the company of a bunch of AA and Earth friends, my wife and I stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. Folks, we're not given another chance at life. We're given another life to start all over again with a clean slate. And I can tell you now that that woman is the dearest person on the face of this earth to me. I love her with all of my heart. Whenever I go somewhere to speak, she goes with me if she can. And if not, I know that she's there in spirit. She's here in person tonight, and I'd like you to stand. I'd like you to meet her. Marlene? The gifts of recovery have been so magnificent that it all came flooding into my head on that wedding day last year. And my daughter and I walked down the aisle together, and she looked like a princess in that long, beautiful white gown, train trailing behind her, and I looked like a monkey in my... And I stood in front of that church, and I placed her hand into the hand of the young man that would be, from now on, the other man in her life. And I love my son-in-law. We both do. He's a great young fella. I worried a great deal about it the first time that we went out to dinner, when not long after they had met and it became apparent that it was serious. We all went out to dinner. And the first thing Paul did when he sat down at the table in the restaurant was to order a beer. And he sat there and nursed that thing for 2 hours. And I said, son, you ain't never gonna make it in my little club drinking like that. And he won't. He loves going to AA meetings. He loves seeing what his wife has seen for a lot of years. That's the love and the laughter and the sharing in these rooms. I cried all the way down the aisle at that wedding, but that's not when the greatest tears were to come. The greatest tears were to come at the reception that would follow, because you see, a few days earlier, my little girl had said, Dad, I want to have my first dance with Paul, but I want to have the second dance with you. And I said, oh, sweetie, you better tell me what we're going to dance to so Mom and I can practice a little bit. You see, when I was drinking, I danced a lot like John Travolta and Fred Astaire. But I'm don't dance quite that good anymore. And maybe your mom and I better practice a little bit. And she said, no, Dad, I don't want to tell you what the song is. I'd rather not. Okay. At that reception, I stood at the side of the dance floor with several hundred people, and I watched my little girl and the handsome prince dance around the dance floor. They looked wonderful. And then that song ended. My little girl came and stood in front of me. She reached out her hands and she took mine, and we walked out onto the dance floor and we began to dance. And the words of the song were, did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I'd like to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings. Oh God, what a miracle has been wrought in the lives of this family. As I danced around that dance floor, I looked into that little girl's eyes and I saw love and I saw respect. I had her back again. You gave me my little girl back. You gave me my family back. You gave me my self-respect back. And what more could I ask for, and yet the gifts keep coming? I am the luckiest man on the face of this earth. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a club for us. It's a way of life. It's a way of life that we don't dare stray from because it's given us everything we have and everything we share. And thank God Doc Randall instilled in my mind and in my heart that the only way to keep this wonderful, precious gift is to give it away. And I try to do that, but there's a great truth about this program. The more you give away, the more you get. And at the end of every day, you'll find yourself deeper in debt than when you started, but richer. My granddaddy's sponsor, Bill Hollingsworth, we talked to him just a few days before he died, and he said, as he had so many times, he's still getting better every day. And I knew he meant it, and I knew he believed it, and so do I. Every day is better. Every day is something new. Can there be any wonder then that I would say to you in closing, did you ever know that you are my heroes and you are everything I want to be? And together we can all soar like eagles because he is the wind beneath our wings.